I'm very pleased to invite and have invited my next guest. His name is David Rubenstein. He's the co-founder and co-executive chairman of the Carlyle Group, one of the world's largest and most successful investment firms. But more than that, Mr. Rubenstein is chairman of boards of trustee of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, the Smithsonian Institution. He's an original signer of the Giving Pledge, which was created by Bill Gates for the Bill Gates Foundation, and a recipient of the Carnegie Medal of Philanthropy. Mr. Rubenstein is also the host of the David Rubenstein Show on Bloomberg TV and PBS, and his book that we're going to discuss today is entitled The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Why did you decide to write this particular book?
Well, a couple reasons. One, I have now turned 70 years old. I've been on four university boards, and I haven't written a book. I began to feel, geez, you're 70 years old. I've served on the Duke board, the Hopkins board, Chicago board, and the Harvard board, and I'm feeling like I'm the only person on these boards who hasn't written a book. So that was one factor, but that's obviously tongue-in-cheek. And the truth is that I started a program about 6 years ago to try to educate members of Congress a little bit more about American history. And I did it by inviting one of the best historians in the country, you know, at a given time, let's say Doris Kearns Goodwin or David McCullough, someone like that, to the Library of Congress, where I would interview them and after a dinner that I would host for members of Congress. And we've now done it for a number of years. I've done about 50 of these interviews, and members of Congress regard it as one of the most interesting things they're doing in Congress, at least that's what they tell me. We ask members to come and sit with people from the opposite party in the opposite house, which they rarely get to do in a public setting. And then they get educated for about an hour of my interviews of these individuals, and then we give them a copy of the book that we've talked about. And we also display, thanks to the Library of Congress, documents from the individual period of time that we're doing the book. So if it's Alexander Hamilton, there'll be things about Alexander Hamilton.
Right.
So I decided I would take about 16 of the best interviews, put them together in a book, and you know, have a little summary up front, and then do the transcripts slightly edited. And that's what we did, and the book seems to be receiving a pretty good audience.
So you list David McCullough speaking on John Adams, John Meacham on Thomas Jefferson, Doris Kearns Goodwin on Abraham Lincoln, and so on. But you've also added something that I thought was pretty interesting, which was an interview with Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts.
Right.
And when you questioned, he said he never really wanted to be a judge or a lawyer, but he wanted to be a historian. What did his father say when he told him that?
Well, he said that, John, there's no money in being a historian. You'll write books nobody will ever read. You won't be able to support your family. But little John said, yes, I want to do this. And so as he got older, he kept wanting to be a historian, went to Harvard, majored in history. And so when he came back from spring break one year, he got into a cab at the Logan Airport and said to the cab driver, please take me to Harvard. And the student and the driver said, are you a student at Harvard? Yes, I am. What are you majoring in? Majoring in history. Cab driver said, well, when I was a student at Harvard, that's what I majored in also, which made John think maybe his father had some good ideas, so John went to law school.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed Gregory Zuckerman, who wrote the Jim Simon biography, the great mathematical investor, and there was a similar joke. The joke was, what is the difference between a mathematician and a pizza? And the answer is that a pizza can feed a family of four.
Well, that's a good point, except Jim can now feed a family of 4 million or 4 billion probably because, as you know from reading the book, Jim has built just about the best hedge fund track record of the last 20 or 30 years or so.
I know.
He and I have gotten to know each other because we served on the Institute for Advanced Study Board for many years, where he oversaw the investment committee, obviously did very well. Jim built an incredible company in Renaissance, and his track record is the envy of virtually every manager in the world.
I know, over 60%, and it's hard to believe that anybody can actually achieve that rate of return over that long period of time.
Well, the way he did it is simply that he's an extraordinary mathematician, one of the best mathematicians in the country at the time he retired from mathematics and went into investing. And he basically found little areas of discrepancy between markets and various prices, and so he was able to developed the so-called quant method or black box method of investing, and it just finds little inefficiencies in the markets, gets in there, fills them, and then does quite well.
So you didn't shy away from controversial topics in this book, and I want to get to them today. John Meacham, on the difficult questions surrounding Thomas Jefferson. So let's delve into that a little bit. In the book, there was a quote that no one ever said it better, speaking about Thomas Jefferson, and no one ever really fell so short. What does he mean by that?
Well, Thomas Jefferson wrote a sentence in the Declaration of Independence preamble. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That one sentence became more or less the creed of our country. Now, we obviously haven't honored it in so many ways, but that's what people wanted us to be. That's what Abraham Lincoln was referring to in his famous sentence in the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, yeah, we brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So Thomas Jefferson wrote that sentence, that all men are created equal, but how could he have done that when he had two slaves with him in Philadelphia when he wrote it? He had over 200 slaves at his plantation in Monticello. How could he have meant this? Now, there are two schools of thought. One is that he meant, in theory, all men are created equal. They just can't live together as equals because of different backgrounds and so forth. Or all white men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think John was probably opting towards thinking that's what Thomas Jefferson really meant.
Well, it was put into law to some degree with regards to the idea that the non-whites were two-thirds of a person?
Three-fifths.
Three-fifths of a person? How did that come about?
Well, in the Constitutional Convention, they had to decide how many delegates people would get into the House of Representatives, for example, based on population. Well, do you count a slave as one person, or do you count a slave as less than one person? Mm. Well, if you're from the South, you want them counted because that would make your population be greater and you'd have more people in the House of Representatives. But if you're in the North, you'd say, why are you counting these people as people? Because, you know, you don't treat them as humans. And so why should we consider you being allowed to have these count as humans? So they ultimately came up with a compromise that was proposed of three-fifths. So each slave would count as three-fifths of a human for the purpose of three-fifths of a white person, I should say, for purposes of census and for purposes of congressional proportion.
Now, in the interview with John Meacham, there's a large discussion about Sally Hemings, who was age 16 at the time. And the age of consent back then, I think, was 12, wasn't it?
In Virginia, it was 12, increased from 10, where it once was.
Mm-hmm.
Sally Hemings was this is the very interesting point. Thomas Jefferson had a relationship with her. You can say it was a forced relationship. You can say it's rape. You can say it was consensual. We'll never know. She was probably not literate. She never wrote about it. And Thomas Jefferson never really wrote about her in any of the letters we have. So we don't really know the nature of the relationship. We don't have any pictures of her. We don't know what she looked like. But we do know that she was probably three-fourths white. And therefore, she was very fair-skinned. When Thomas Jefferson saw her, she was 16. And he began a relationship with her for, as I say, some 30 years. Why was he struck with her? Well, there may have been many reasons, but one is this, probably. His wife died when Thomas Jefferson was 39 years old, and she asked him not to marry again. And because she didn't want her two daughters to have a stepmother, because she'd had a stepmother, and she didn't like that. Thomas Jefferson agreed he wouldn't get married again. He didn't say he would be celibate forever, but he didn't say he wouldn't be married again. When Thomas Jefferson saw Sally Hemings, he was probably seeing his wife as a young woman, because Sally Hemings' father was also the father of Thomas Jefferson's wife. He was a slave owner, and he impregnated a slave, and the result of that impregnation was Sally Hemings. So Thomas Jefferson may have been seeing, in effect, when he saw Sally Hemings, a 16-year-old version of his wife, and maybe he fell in love with that version again.
So Sally Hemings was his wife's half-sister, essentially.
That's correct.
Yeah. So she was light-skinned, you mentioned, and he took her to France, and there's a story there about how she could have stayed in France, which, you know, had no policy for slavery, and she could have become free, but she came back with Thomas Jefferson. What is that story?
Yes. Well, what happened was Thomas Jefferson had two daughters who survived, you know, he had four total, but two died young. So one was with him in France when he was serving as an effect as our ambassador, and then the other one was too young to be brought over early on, but then eventually when she was nine, she was brought over, but she was thought by 9 years old to be too young to go on a ship to France by herself, so she had a chaperone, Sally Hemings. When Sally Hemings arrived with the daughter, Thomas Jefferson obviously was struck with her. They apparently start up a relationship. He impregnated her, though the result of that impregnation did not survive. But Thomas Jefferson apparently said to her, according to Sally Hemings' child from Thomas Jefferson, who wrote a book about it later, that the deal was, if you come back from France with me, yes, you'll be a slave again, but I promise that I will free our children at the age of 21 or upon my death. And he did. He didn't free her upon his death for reasons I could explain, but he did free the children that they had together with four of them at the end of his life.
Very complicated story, but I think you have to look at the times, and especially when you're thinking about what the age of consent is at age 10 or age 12.
Right.
It's all in context with the times. Now, of all of the accomplishments of Thomas Jefferson, I think he was most proud of his writing of the Declaration of Independence. What transpired during the writing and actually during the acceptance of it that really turned off Thomas Jefferson to the whole thing?
Thomas Jefferson, at the age of 33, was asked to write a draft of what became the Declaration of Independence. There were a committee of five people, including John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. Thomas Jefferson, like many humans, he had 17 days to do it. He waited to the last 3 days because he was busy and put it off. He wrote it essentially from memory of what he wanted to say. He didn't have a lot of books to write it from, but he wrote out what was pretty much the conventional wisdom he would say at the time about some of these issues. When it was given to the committee, they made some modest changes. They knew he was very sensitive to changes. But when it got to be voted on by the entire Continental Congress on July the 3rd and July the 4th, they made about 60-some changes, and he was very upset with them. In fact, so upset that he wrote letters to his friends saying, here's my version, and here's what they did. Don't you think my version is better? But ultimately, of course, the Congress agreed to its version. And one of the main changes was that he had blamed King George for the slave trade. And one, it wasn't really true. King George hadn't forced the slave trade on him. Slave trading had gone on well before King George.
Yeah.
But secondly, and most importantly, perhaps, nobody in the Continental Congress wanted to mention slavery in the Constitution because it was very controversial, and many of the people there didn't want to mention slavery, so it was never mentioned. But if I say the Constitution, I should have said in the Declaration of Independence, it was never mentioned, nor was it ever mentioned in the Constitution either. Thomas Jefferson was so upset with the changes that were made, he never spoke up because he never didn't like to speak in public. He only made one speech as the President of the United States in public. He hated speaking in public, and when the Declaration of Independence was being edited by the Continental Congress, he never spoke up about it, but he was upset about it. But he was so upset about it, he said that they had mutilated what he had written. For 8 or 9 years, he didn't admit publicly that he had written it. Later, when it became a very famous document, he later admitted it. And as you suggest, he was so proud of it that when he figured out what he wanted to have on his tombstone, the first thing was author of the Declaration of Independence.
My guest is David Rubenstein. The book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. David, I want to switch gears here and talk about your interview with Bob Woodward on President Nixon. In that interview, you know, Bob says that there was an extreme cover-up and he had difficulty getting people to talk. People were quite fearful. Tell us a little bit about that part of the story.
Well, in those days, the President of the United States was thought to be fairly invulnerable and people didn't want to be talking to a reporter who wasn't really famous then. Nobody really knew who Bob Woodward was or Carl Bernstein, and nobody wanted to get themselves in trouble. And so it was very difficult, and Bob Woodward, as he describes in the interview and in his books about this, knocked on doors and just did a lot of shoe leather work to get people to talk, and eventually he did get some good sources, the most famous of which is, of course, Deep Throat. It is an unusual situation compared to today, because today, when President Trump had his situation in terms of impeachment, there was a big reservoir of support in the country for him among his supporters, and there was a television network that was pretty supportive of him. Nixon didn't have that. Nixon had a reasonable support in the Republican Party, but it wasn't intense, and Nixon didn't have a media and social media kind of things that President Trump has, so it was a completely different environment. We tend to forget in those days, most people who cared about the news would get it from 15 minutes of evening news, CBS, NBC, or ABC at night. That was it. There were no cable TV shows. There was no social media, and the newspapers were relatively less significant in some respects than the social media is today.
But there was a feeling back then by Nixon that the office of the presidency protected him, that he had rights of protection and the ability to do pretty much anything that he wanted to. There seems to be a similar, you know, feeling today with the current government as well.
Well, I'll just say, with respect to Nixon, in hindsight, I think most people would say that if he wanted to survive, he should have destroyed the tapes. Because in the end, had he not had those tapes, people wouldn't have seen his language. They wouldn't have seen the cover-up language that was in the tapes. Nixon did not destroy the tapes, most people would say, probably because he thought that he was not likely to be forced to turn them over by the Supreme Court. He ultimately was in a 9-0 decision. But had he not had the tapes, he probably would have survived. Had he burned the tapes, he would have probably survived. And if he hadn't had a few things on those tapes, he probably would have survived, but he didn't. He never believed that those tapes would become public. And why did he preserve the tapes? He preserved them because he wanted to have an accurate view, in his view, of history. So when he wrote his memoirs, he would be able to say, this is what actually happened. I have, you know, very good evidence of it.
I think Bob Woodward also said in the interview that Nixon thought the tapes would exonerate him, that he was living in this kind of unreal bubble.
Well, I suspect he may have felt that way at times because he may have forgotten some of the things that were on the tapes. But anybody who listened to tapes for a while would realize that President Nixon was involved in the cover-up, so-called. And, you know, Nixon just was his own lawyer, advisor, I guess, at that point, and he was not probably advising himself very well.
In Nixon's resignation speech, he said something to the effect, always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself. And the one characteristic Bob Woodward kept mentioning was about the hate that Nixon had for others.
There's a term in psychology or psychiatry where you call it, it's called projection, or a word I should say. Projection means you accuse somebody of something, but you're actually, you're responsible for it yourself. You do that yourself. And that's really what Nixon was doing. Nixon was saying exactly what he was doing. He hated other people, and he, in effect, destroyed himself.
Mm-hmm. He also hated anybody that went against him or, you know, was not loyal to him.
I think most politicians are probably that way. I wouldn't say it was just Nixon. I think most politicians, and certainly presidents I've known, they want loyalty for those people who work for them in the White House. And it's very difficult to get complete loyalty because lots of people like to talk to reporters and lots of people have different views than the president, even though they're working for him. I think Nixon did like to have people around him who were intensely loyal. And the two most significant aides to him, John Ehrlichman and Bob Haldeman, were intensely loyal, but they couldn't control everything.
Now, Barry Goldwater was very much involved in the impeachment back then. And in his personal diary in the last days of Nixon, Nixon knows he's going to be impeached in the House. The question is, what will the Senate do? Which is always the question. We just went through that right now, right?
Right. That's correct. And so the delegation went to see Nixon. It was led by the Senate Republican leader, Hugh Scott. And Barry Goldwater, being a very prominent person, came along as well. And there were one or two other senators. And Barry Goldwater said, Mr. President, we've done a count in the Senate, and we think you've got six votes, and one of them is not mine. In other words, Barry Goldwater wasn't even going to support Nixon. So when Nixon heard that, he, I think, resigned the next day.
Well, to me, the power of that statement is he needed 34 votes.
Right.
And he asked, you know, how many votes do I have? 20 votes? And then Barry Goldwater says, no, you have, as you say, six votes, but one of them isn't mine. I mean, that's a statement of fact right in his face. And the next day, Nixon resigned. It seemed to me that back then, the Senate was more incensed about the lying that Nixon did to try to cover everything up.
Well, it's hard to make the comparisons, but I would say that Nixon's popularity in the country at that point was very, very low. And the Senate reflected that. The Senate Republican leadership reflected that. Whatever you might think of what President Trump did or what he said, his popularity among his key supporters is still very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the Republican senators, you know, they can sense from their own constituents what their constituents' views are. And I think that is what would be very helpful to President Trump, that his popularity among his Republican base is extremely high, much, much higher than Nixon's was at a comparable period of time.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really see very many aspects of the Nixon impeachment era and today's impeachment era.
Well, there's some similarities, but remember, the Senate then was controlled by the Democrats, and the Senate is now controlled by the Republicans. So
yeah,
it's a different situation in that respect. And I'd say that the social media impact, the impact of television that is very much in favor of, let's say, one person or another, is much different than it was. So it's always tempting to kind of draw analogies and say it's similar to what it was before, but it was really completely different situation again. Nixon's popularity was much less in his party. The party that controlled the Senate was not his party. The outrage at what he was said on the tape, the expletives deleted, and the clear sign of a cover-up were just evidence that you couldn't say it's perfect.
The book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians, and their interviews with these historians on John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, even Charles Lindbergh, Martin Luther King, Lyndon Johnson, and so on. David Rubenstein, thank you so much for taking your time to spend with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. My mission is always to educate you. And I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love to get your questions and your comments because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them for you. So if you have a question about your 401k, about your retirement, or anything monetary or financially involved, visit us at our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. Go to the contact section and let me know how we can help at stevepomerantz.com.